Welcome to The B-Word, a podcast about humans, organizations, behavior. I'm your host, James Healy.
As regular listeners will know, the behavioral insights movement really began in earnest in 2008 with the publication of Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein's Nudge. A couple of years later, the Nudge Unit, more formally known as the Behavioral Insights Team, was created in 10 Downing Street by then UK PM David Cameron. 13 years later, there are hundreds of similar units in governments and large corporates around the world. Yet many of the tools now used by behavioral insights teams long predate Nudge. The advertising industry has been using techniques like social norms, the messenger effect, and salience for decades in the form of memorable slogans, celebrity endorsements, annoying jingles, and many, many more. It's not really surprising. Advertising exists specifically to change behavior, to get people to buy a product or service. Few things impact a company's success, like how much they're selling. Of course, they want experts in human behavior to help them do that. Yet it often feels like the lessons learned long ago by advertisers are only just being learned by those parts of the organization that deal with employees rather than customers. But humans are humans, whether they're working for your organization or buying from it. It's about time the HR department and the compliance department and many other departments besides started learning from the marketing department. In this episode, I'm joined by one of the leading figures in applied behavioral science, and a global legend in the advertising industry, Rory Sutherland. Rory is the vice chairman of Ogilvy, which in his words is an attractively vague job title that, among other things, allowed him to co-found a behavioral science practice within the agency. Before that, Rory was a copywriter and creative director at Ogilvy for over 20 years, having joined as a graduate trainee in 1988. He's variously been president of the IPA, chair of the judges for the direct jury at Cannes, and has spoken at TED Global. Rory writes regular columns for The Spectator, Market Leader, and Impact, and also occasional pieces for Wired. He's the author of three books, The Wiki Man, Alchemy, The Surprising Power of Ideas Which Don't Make Sense, and Transport for Humans. Rory, thank you very much for joining me.
Ah, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with a question some of my listeners might be asking. Why is a guy who advises clients on things like adopting new technology, changing culture, cybersecurity, talking to an advertising guy? Or to put it another way, what can HR departments learn from their friends in marketing?
A very interesting question. Funnily enough, about 6 years ago, I was asked to speak at a conference on, I think it was compliance, actually. Now, at the time, you know, to get me to attend a conference on compliance, I barely would have done it with a gun to my head. But it so happened I was speaking there, and I also turned up early. And I suddenly realized it was fascinating because it was like marketing in reverse. Marketing was, of course, the art of getting people to do things you wanted them to do. And compliance was the art of getting people not to do things you really didn't want them to do. And I realized that effectively it was the obverse of the same coin. And I also discovered that whereas at its worst, compliance and quite a lot of internal communication to staff turns into a ghastly box-ticking exercise, which I think has been an increasing problem, in recent years. You know, the number of online things you have to agree to, which realistically you're never going to bloody read, and so on, has got ridiculous. There was a growing realization within those fields that actually the box-ticking thing was either ineffectual or, in some cases, absolutely counterproductive. And that you needed to deploy some psychology and some behavioral science really to get things to work. And I have to say, I think there's something very interesting And I think this is what we have in common. It's what I used to call the broken binoculars, which is most decisions we make about people, not in our personal lives, but in our professional lives, we lean very heavily on two things, one of which is broken lens one, conventional market research. You rely on people to tell you what they want, okay? And broken lens two is kind of assumptions from, you know, neoliberal economics, that, you know, people have a utility function, they have perfect information, perfect trust, and that all your employees are simply seeking to maximize their own utility. And the point about these two is that at best they're distorting, and at worst they're downright dangerous as assumptions. Firstly, because people can't really tell you what they want, okay? You know, many of the things that people really, really value emotionally, you know, fairness, for example, or autonomy, okay, tend not to be felt or voiced desire. Well, they're felt, but they're not really voiced desires. And neoliberal economics, I think, is pretty terrible because for a whole variety of reasons, you know, it tends to boil down to, you know, when you need people to change their behavior, you either bribe them or you fine them. You know, it tends to rely too heavily, not on persuasion, which is enduring and in some ways deep and self-perpetuating. It relies on instead what you might call either the legal or the economic mode of changing people, which is either forcing them to do things or bribing them to do things. And those are necessary, by the way, very necessary in some cases. I'm simply saying that's not where you should start. I always find it strange in politics that politics is basically a bunch of lawyers who sometimes take advice from economists, as Richard Thaler put it. And anyone interested in helping out the lawyers need not apply. And what tends to happen in politics is you have a mode of thinking which is legislation first, incentives second, and only then might you then resort to persuasion. Now, all three are valuable in their different ways, but that has to be the wrong way around. You should persuade people to do what you want them to do first, and only in cases where that fails should you resort to something else.
I was actually thinking of the Thaler quote as you were talking, and thinking of the applicability of that to organizations. It's so similar. Organizations' first instinct is to tell you not to do something. Perhaps they might then get on to changing the incentive structures. I spent a good part of the early portion of my career in large investment banks, wandering around trading floors, trying to get people who were paid millions of pounds for doing things to stop doing them because I had it written down in a policy. And you can probably figure out how well that worked.
Oh, I can just imagine, yeah. I mean, it's interesting too, because I think we're much more creative as individuals than we are as corporate individuals. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. One of them is kind of defensive decision-making, which is that by doing the logical thing, you won't get into any trouble, okay? You know, quite a lot of IT activity, you must have noticed, is effectively, and you can smell it immediately when you get the email, we want you to agree to this thing, really for no better reason than it will cover our arse. It won't stop you doing it, it won't affect your behavior, but because we've told you not to do it, our arses are now safely covered. Okay. The other thing is that there is a tendency that when you want to signal, quite a lot of activity in business isn't actually solving problems. It's signaling that you care about the problem and you're doing all you can to prevent it, okay, to your bosses. And if you want to signal that you care about a problem rather than solving a problem, and they're very different, the way of signaling that you care about a problem means you intervene against it head on, directly, with no obliquity, no creativity, nothing remotely counterintuitive, okay? It's just what you might call a brute force approach. Now, in complex systems, problems are quite frequently not best solved by a head-on intervention, a brute force approach. They're solved surprisingly simply sometimes, obliquely, creatively, you know, using some degree of psychology and some degree of kind of counterintuitive logic. And so I think one of the things is that signaling that you care is not the same as solving someone's problem. And then, I mean, the most extreme example of this is a book by Paul Zak, which I think is called, if I'm right, it's called something like Pathological Altruism, or the, here we are, let me find the exact title for your readership, because he makes the point that altruism, for example, isn't necessarily a particularly useful emotion, or that perhaps it's an emotion which deploys itself inappropriately in a complex world of billions of people. Because showing you care and solving someone's problem don't generally overlap all that much.
I like that. I'm not familiar with that.
I think it's a really important. It's actually against empathy, but it's the same kind of thing. The showing of empathy, the showing of altruism, generally can actually cause us to engage in remarkably ineffectual behaviors that are really designed to show that we care. His book's called Against Empathy. Thanks. I knew it was, I was close to the title there, but that strikes me as a very interesting, he calls it the case for rational compassion. And I think that's important. I mean, I find it so interesting talking to the finance department, because I take an extreme kind of right-wing view where I'll occasionally say things like, look, you don't actually need to make your employees rich. You need to make them feel rich. Okay? And I've been a vociferous critic of things like getting rid of company cars and perks. Okay? Because if, you know, to some extent, by being fairly lavish with what is, after all, very tax-efficient incentives, you satisfy people's appetite for bling to a degree. Okay? They're being perfectly rational, I think, in being happy being paid less and having more in other forms of remuneration. I'm very, very interested in having a wider and more intelligent debate around flexible working. Because what's happened post-COVID is that in the relationship between employee and employer, it was previously the case. I mean, I always said what people value is a complicated mixture of free when, free where, free time, money, and, you know, working with people they really enjoy, free who. Okay. Now, historically, the only two of those that were negotiable were how much you got paid and how long you worked. And actually, even how long you worked, when you worked, where you worked, how you worked, was not, for the most part, very negotiable. Because, you know, one of the reasons nobody took a four-day week, I'll tell you why, is because if you were the only person doing a four-day week, you'd end up working 5 days a week and getting paid for four. So unsurprisingly, people weren't very willing to take that option. And so what I find interesting is that autonomy, to a degree, is now a negotiable variable in people's terms of employment, along with working hours and money. Now, what that should do, if we're being proper economists, okay, is to say, the addition of extra variables in work, okay, should lead to new and more beneficial forms of value exchange between the employer and the employee. I mean, if I value autonomy, the ability to work from the seaside 2 days a week, okay, more than I value money, okay, and it costs my employer less to offer me the 2 days by the seaside than it would cost them to compensate me for sacrificing them, okay, productivity being equal, you'd be an insane not to explore that possibility, wouldn't you?
Yes.
And so, I mean, there are wider questions I also ask, which is, everybody says, ooh, do we want our employees to be able to work flexibly? To which I answer, don't only think about your employees. There's also a question about your customers, because it may be in the interest of business to promote flexible working, even if it makes them less efficient, if it significantly increases the discretionary income that consumers have, if it reduces the amount they have to spend on transportation and housing costs by living in a really expensive city and travelling in by tube every day, which typically among young Londoners mops up more than 50% of their after-tax income. Okay? If you can reduce that by 20%, okay, that's a lot of extra money in the productive economy. So we shouldn't just look at this as a question of productivity.
I really like that, and it's something I've heard from, you know, a lot of people I work with. I'm still young enough that I recall being one of those Londoners waving goodbye to large chunks of my disposable income to transport for London every month. And yeah, I think it's...
By the way, there's a third benefit, which is if people vary their times of commuting, the UK, without spending a penny on infrastructure, ends up with a world-class road and rail network.
I think that's another great point. And I know that transport is a topic very close to your heart. I was going to go there a bit later, but I think there's some great examples of this. So let's talk about those now. In your first book, or Alchemy, which we will come back to, but in Alchemy, you have some great anecdotes about transport, which obviously are built out much more fully in Transport for Humans. One of my favorites is about you not using your GPS when traveling to the airport. And I think it's a great example or a great way of explaining the difference between logic and the way that humans really behave.
Well, I think what's really interesting, by the way, I think the GPS is an interesting, what you might call, microcosm model of how we should respond to AI. Which is, we should allow it to inform and illuminate our thinking without allowing it to confine our thinking. And, you know, I'd be very worried about AI making decisions without, without some sort of reference to a human being. Okay? I personally, and I made this point earlier, I don't even accept fully the idea of speed cameras. Now, just to be clear, I think a speed camera which took 60 seconds of footage, sent it to a human being who was given the discretion to let a certain number of people off, given the circumstances, would probably be acceptable, okay? But the point is, an AI only cares about what it's been told to care about. Everything else is invisible. The great thing that humans do is, whether they like it or not, they will bring in other factors if they think they're being neglected, or if they think they're relevant. So my example of ignoring my... Now, one example with a speed camera is, there are cases where you should probably break the speed limit. I once got done by a speed camera by basically accelerating to avoid a dangerous drunk, okay? Now, no cop would have arrested me. I've been done by speed cameras quite deservedly. I'm not one of those people who goes, oh, no, it's totally unfair. I'd also say that on an empty dual carriageway with no pedestrians at 1 o'clock in the morning, someone going 46 in a 40 zone shouldn't be fined. Okay? You know, I think that you should have some sort of wiggle room in terms of what's considered punitive. Okay? Because otherwise it just gets ridiculous. But the third point I'd make is that there's another consideration you have to make, which a human would make, which a speed camera wouldn't, which is, hold on, if this speed camera is catching a huge number of people, it could be, because this is an unbelievably dangerous stretch of road frequented by lunatic drivers, okay? Or it could be because the signage is inadequate. Or that you have an utterly... Because let's face it, we could all design a speed camera which caught everybody, couldn't we? Right? You know, you have a stretch of road where you're driving at 60, you come around the corner, there's a 30 limit with a speed camera 10 feet further on. Okay? Right? I mean, you could just catch everybody. Okay? And in some cases, the question is not assuming that everybody who breaks the law here is a miscreant. It's also asking the reverse question, which is there something wrong about the road layout or the signage or the distance between the speed restriction sign and the camera, which is causing this to be disproportionately unfair. And so in the case of the GPS, the example I give is, you know, if I go to the airport, the GPS will basically go, this is the fastest way to get to the airport on average, and it also factor in some current road traffic information, okay? But if I'm not in a desperate hurry, I will possibly choose the second best way to the airport, the one that says extra 8 minutes, if that other route has a lower variance outcome. So the fastest route in the UK is quite often a motorway. Motorways are on average very fast. When motorways go wrong, they go really, really wrong. You get total gridlock and you can be stuck there for 45 minutes. I'd rather know I was going to be 15 minutes slower, give or take 5 minutes, than take the risk of missing my flight because the, you know, Clackett Lane motorway had a complete, you know, bumper to bumper gridlock situation. And so I will then choose the lower variance, higher duration option, knowing in part that the sat nav isn't factoring in what I'm really trying to do, which is not to get there as quickly as possible. It's definitely not to get there too late. And, you know, sat-navs can't understand scenic routes either, by the way, can they? Okay. You know, I remember driving down the Loire Valley with a sat-nav, and of course it went completely crazy because there's some interstate, which you can, obviously a French route nationale or autoroute, which you can take, which bypasses all the interesting castles. And of course, I just turned it off because, I mean, it had no knowledge of aesthetics whatsoever. And I think what tends to happen when you have any system that optimizes against a certain number of variables is that the variables it doesn't include can come back to bite you. You know, well, I mean, other things that, you know, might happen with sat navs. I mean, they can be, by the way, I noticed they're disproportionately reluctant to send you in the wrong direction. I think because it really, really annoys people. There are quite a lot of cases where it makes sense actually to double back 4 miles, get on a fast road, stay on a fast road. But sat-navs tend to hate doing that, I think, because a certain number of people, particularly people who are obsessed with kind of fuel consumption, will get really, really ratty at that. But again, that's a matter of individual preference involving a whole load of information that, you know, lies outside its consideration set. And then, you know, you get to other wider questions like, how do I get to the airport? And to make that decision, you know, an intelligent human will factor in about 15 different factors. You know, what's the weather like? How much luggage am I carrying? How long am I going for? Because obviously, if you're going for 2 weeks, car parking is going to be bloody expensive. Whereas if you're going overnight, car parking is cheaper than the taxi. You know, do I go by train or not? Well, it kind of depends how much luggage I'm carrying and a load of other factors. And so those decisions actually involve effectively weighing up quite a large number of variables to arrive at a sensible decision. And, you know, it's not all of those variables, by the way, are actually really numerically expressible. You know, am I traveling with 4 other people? That is numerically expressible, I suppose. How large is your party? But I mean, things like climate, you know, for example, God, it's pissing down. I don't want to have to walk to the station or whatever. Those things do involve a degree of subjective judgment, which presumably, you know, are more and more difficult for models to actually make commensurable with the other numerical variables they're looking at.
I think, in a word,
microcosm, which is we should use them to inspire us, and maybe sometimes to get us out of the shit, which after all sat navs do. But we shouldn't defer to them completely, because that awareness we have of what the sat nav isn't thinking about is actually itself important information.
I think in a word, what all of this boils down to is context, and it's what human beings are very good at doing and what machines, no matter how advanced, are not very good at doing. And of course, context is absolutely critical in driving behavior.
The extent to which, of course, I suppose Ian McGilchrist, in his book The Master and His Emissary, makes this point that the left brain, as he calls it, only knows what it knows. It's very precise, fine-grained, etc., very seemingly logical. But the miracle of the other part of the brain is effectively the yes, but. I'll give you a lovely example of context here, actually, which is actually a failure of human decision-making, but it's interesting, which is that five people in South Wales about 2 weeks ago went missing, and they were all in their kind of, they were all adults, okay? But, they'd, for whatever reason, gone missing completely, and their parents were all fairly distraught. And the police, not wrongly, I think, have a policy that no one counts as a missing person until 24 hours has passed. Now, I can see why, okay? You can see why the police have that policy, because brutal as it may seem, that doesn't apply with a child, by the way, it applies with an adult. If you weren't careful, you could end up basically spending half of police hours trying to track down people who'd merely gone to the pub or something like that, okay? And it wouldn't be fair for a person's degree of anxiety to direct police attention to that extent. But in this case, they probably made a mistake, because their car had gone off the road. Three of them, I think, were dead and two seriously injured. I don't know whether the dead people were dead on impact. But what was interesting there is probably, okay, given there were five of them simultaneously, okay, given they'd been in a car, quite a lengthy car journey of some kind, I would have said that was a case where an astute cop would say, I'm going to break the rule. I don't blame the cop for not doing it. The rule's the rule. But I would have said that it was actually a failure. It was a classic case of context blind adherence to a rule.
I would agree. And I think that that phenomenon explains many, many things. Earlier today, I was listening to a rather alarming report from someone in the banking industry about commercial real estate and mortgage-backed securities. And of course, it all harks back 15 years to the financial crisis, where, of course, we had very sophisticated models developed by very sophisticated mathematicians, which failed to predict context, failed to predict the one thing that could go wrong.
Well, first of all, I suppose it failed to spot that property prices were to some extent systemically linked. So it regarded a simultaneous collapse in the value of many properties as ridiculously unlikely. If I'm right, that's probably fair, isn't it?
Correct, yes.
And so statistically, they basically made a very... I mean, this worries me a lot, by the way, because statistically, it is inevitable, right, that really, really good statisticians are massively outnumbered by average or merely pretty good statisticians, okay? I'm assuming a bell curve of statistical ability here. Now, here's my take, okay? That's also true of plumbers, that really brilliant plumbers are outnumbered by merely average jobbing plumbers. But jobbing plumbers are still useful. There are still a lot of jobs they can do and they can perform. I would argue that averagely good statisticians are probably on balance dangerous more than they're useful. And, it does strike me. So you have the assumption, slightly weird assumptions on what constituted an X sigma event and so forth. You also have the problem that I suppose you completely fail to spot the extent to which people would game the system. That essentially the people selling mortgages, because they were selling them on, had no skin in the game. And so it was effectively in their interests to keep on basically lending money to any klutz. They also didn't notice a psychological thing, which I think is important, by the way, which is when people buy houses and borrow money to buy houses, they do not act in the same way as they do when buying anything else. In that most people work out how much they can borrow, add a deposit, okay, and then look for houses that cost that much. So there's a natural heuristic in human house buying behavior, which I suppose over the last 30 years kind of makes sense because the capital gains were so huge and you can't borrow equivalent amounts of money to buy stocks, for example, or any other form of investment product. So here was a product where you could bet the farm and which had gone up at an astonishing rate. Okay. So you had a fairly massive degree of, you know, multiple in there. Okay. And so people had just learned whatever's the most expensive house you can afford, you should buy that. The slight problem with that is it fairly obviously then causes house prices to go up. Now, if you think about it, okay, if we bought cars that way, the way we bought houses, you know, we'd all be driving around in a kind of Porsche or Bugatti Veyron, right? We don't do that because we don't buy cars that way. We recognize that they depreciate and there's a trade-off between, you know, kind of price and utility at some point. And we make a measured decision, but we don't do that with houses. We basically go, if someone's prepared to lend me this money and I can get it, I'm going to buy it because, you know, they're looking entirely at the investment value, not at the use value, really. And so what was so fascinating about the film, I thought, The Big Short, was that all the people who spotted the problem were odd and at the margins. There was a kind of anthropological thing going on, really. And of course, some of the people who spotted it took the extraordinary step, or only extraordinary, I suspect, if you work in a financial modeling department at an investment bank, of going to Florida and talking to people in the property market to see what was going on. And, you know, there is an awful lot you can learn by effectively, you know, going to Florida and looking at events on the ground, which won't be captured by any model.
Yes, I previously had Gillian Tett on, who you might be familiar with.
Yes, no, she's written both a book called Anthrovision and also a very, very good book called The Silo Effect, I think it is. But she's fascinating because she's an anthropologist who's turned an anthropologist's eye to the world of business. And she was one of the people who spotted, I think, the Morgan Mafia and predicted a kind of financial crisis before 2008.
Correct. And her other book, which I have read, I can't remember the name of it now, but it is essentially, it tells the story of the financial crisis.
Fool's Gold.
Fool's Gold, thank you.
Yeah.
But there's this wonderful scene in there where she describes being in, I believe it's in the south of France somewhere, at the world's leading mortgage-backed securities conference in sort of the summer of 2007. And it's got all of those Hollywood touches of, you know, champagne and all the rest of it. But as you say, she brings this anthropological eye. And one of the things that she talks about, again, it's obviously context, but this importance that anthropology places on the things that people aren't talking about,
yeah,
the silences. And I think there's huge relevance. And I think, again, so much comes back to context. So much comes back to data essentially coming from the past and data without context being very dangerous.
Yeah, and actually, it's worth noting that most of the statistical techniques, like, for example, averaging or looking for correlation, are actually destructive of nuance, aren't they? I was absolutely fascinated by Nassim Taleb's work on IQ, which shows that there is a correlation between IQ and, you know, financial life outcome. But the vast majority of that correlation is driven by the left-hand side of the curve. Now, when you think about it, okay, it wouldn't be that uncommon for a proxy indicator to work very well negatively, okay, but not to work so well positively. And let me give a little example, okay. If you're using IQ as an example of, you know, life outcome, you could probably say that someone who has difficulty grasping even basic concepts and finds literacy difficult is less likely to, you know, than most people to become markedly successful. Okay. Now, in the same way, okay, you could also say if you were using, say, cricketing ability to determine people's soccer playing ability, you could also confidently predict that most people who are rubbish at cricket would also be rubbish at soccer. You know, they basically lack hand-eye coordination or indeed any interest in sport, for example. There could be a lot of negatives, okay, which would mean that that would carry over fairly well. You know, total shitness at cricket would probably predict fairly reliably at least below average performance in soccer, okay? I don't think you can say the same at the opposite end of the scale. I don't think you can say that brilliant cricketers would all have been brilliant soccer players. And so those kind of asymmetries, that's a great subtitle of Nassim's book, Anti-Fragile. I think it's the hidden asymmetries in everyday life. And those asymmetries quite often get lost in the act of aggregation or some other form of thing. But also, you're right. I mean, all big data comes from the past. There's obviously a huge case of quantification bias because not all valuable data actually can be expressed in a numerical form. I mean, most interestingly, okay, I would say as a marketer, we don't have SI units for human emotions, okay? So you know, the assumption we made, oh, the other thing is the assumption of linearity or effectively of straight line relationships is another really, really kind of dodgy, I think. It's a really dodgy assumption that tends to permeate quite a lot of dangerous assumptions once people are presented with something statistical. You know, yes, people prefer faster trains, okay? Broadly speaking, I think that's true, although people don't want scenic railways to be too fast because then the journey would only take 3 minutes. Okay, there are contextual exceptions. But does that mean, for example, that, as indeed happened in the UK, they refused to accept a better route for High Speed 2 that went along the route of the M40 motorway, therefore not creating much environmental damage because there was already a motorway there? Because it was 4 minutes slower in getting to Manchester, okay? Well, do you seriously believe that anyone's behaviour is going to be significantly affected by whether the journey takes 37 minutes or 41? You know, I think that's absolute rubbish, if you're being honest about it. And so that assumption that there's this linear relationship between speed and utility is particularly when you do... when you actually say, well, the valuable question isn't utility, it's behavior. You know, does this persuade more people to take the journey? Okay. Then I think that becomes a really, it's basically stupidity dressed up as mathematics.
I think there's a lot to be said for distrusting mathematics. And I say this very honestly as someone who was terrible at it, which sort of set me on this journey. Linked to that, I'm always amused by the concept of average. And whenever somebody talks about designing something for the average person or the average person in a particular group, I'm always keen to point out there is, of course, no such average person.
Absolutely. And of course, the more measures you add, the more averageness becomes rarer and rarer. Absolutely right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think the reason we average things is for the purposes of comprehension.
Yeah, I think it makes for a nice soundbite. It makes it easier to understand. My personal favorite example of this is I was at a university alumni event a few years ago. And I should say I have a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the LSE. And at this particular alumni event, they somewhat amusingly announced the statistics, and it's just a few years ago, it may have changed now, on the courses at the LSE which have the highest average earnings after graduation.
Yeah.
And I was very surprised to learn that it was actually the philosophy department. Until, of course, they pointed out the reason for this was a chap who'd graduated about 40 years ago, goes by the name of George Soros.
Well, it occurred to me that you very easily could prove that on average, you're much better off dropping out of Harvard for the simple reason that both Zuckerberg and Gates dropped out of Harvard. And their wealth would undoubtedly dwarf the average wealth of Harvard graduates. Particularly as there aren't that many, correct, you know, presumably not that many people drop out of Harvard. So by that measure, the people who do drop out of Harvard are on average spectacularly wealthy. And you can make a very good case that your last year at Harvard cost you, you know, on average 7.5 million of lifetime earnings. And so, no, I mean, undoubtedly, that's Nassim's distinction between extremistan and mediocristan. So Soros did philosophy something like 40 or 50 years ago. And consequently, of course, makes perfect sense.
Yes, the rest of the philosophy graduates of the LSE are very grateful to George. If he could perhaps pass some of it on to the rest of us, we'd be very happy.
That's right. That's absolutely fantastic. I mean, I think there are so many things in which really good statisticians are alert to the inadequacies of a model, whereas actually people who aren't really trained in statistics simply replace reality with the model because it's so much more convenient. And in the case of making decisions in an institutional setting, I always say the model told me to do it is like the 21st century equivalent of I was only obeying orders. You know, that you won't get into trouble, in a sense, for taking a model and following it slavishly. I always make this point about asymmetry in business decision making, which is that it's much, much easier to get fired for being irrational than it is for being unimaginative, for example. And that's one thing that worries me about AI, that it creates a culture where if you agree with the AI, no matter what the consequences are, okay, you won't get into any trouble. And if you go against the AI because you think it may have missed something, and if anything goes wrong subsequently, now you're really, really, you know, head above the parapet. You know, you're exposed to blame, because that would create an extraordinary kind of imbalance, I think, in decision making.
So it's interesting. You can't have a conversation with anyone at the moment without straying onto this topic and whether or not ChatGPT heralds the dawn of utopia or the impending apocalypse. What you just said actually reminded me of something that was in one of your columns recently, where I thought you made a very original point about what ChatGPT is going to mean. And there's a level of motivated reasoning here, but I've sort of been looking at ChatGPT and thinking generative AI hopefully heralds the end of the road for, go back to this word again, people who are average. So if you're an average writer, your days of selling average novels are probably over, because generative AI can do it as well as you can, as quick, but far quicker. But your column recently, I think, was, and you can talk about what you said in that in a moment, but I think you were driving at this point that in order to survive, we would have to take more and more extreme positions to differentiate ourselves.
Yes. So if you wanted to write a sincere thank you letter, if you just wrote a bog standard thank you letter with no swearing, no profanities, no politically incorrect or racist language, your recipient might just merely assume you've got ChatGPT to write it for you. And therefore, you'd be forced to actually put in gratuitous kind of abuse and distasteful language just to prove that you'd made the sincere effort to actually put together a letter of thanks. I mean, there might be a thing, by the way. I mean, there might be a thing, if I'm being optimistic, okay? I'll take one of my eccentric positions. I like taking unfashionable positions because generally fashion gets formed merely by what's salient, plausible, and visible. It doesn't get formed by an objective assessment of the whole situation. So one of the, I take a very strong pro-Diet Coke position, because I simply make the point that you're all burbling on about this and that and the other. But the simple fact is, if you choose or you can't drink alcohol, okay, your life without Diet Coke is absolutely miserable, okay? Don't know why, but there's nothing else that you know. There's nothing else you can drink 2 pints of at a party while, you know, remaining vaguely cheerful. You know, you can have water, but it's boring as hell. You can have orange juice, but it's too sweet and it's a children's drink, you know. So I always like to take the counterpoint. You know, I never understood why whenever there's an article on unhealthy food, there's a picture of a burger, not a pizza, okay? I just, you know, it's just a healthy thing to do. And I suppose in advertising, it's to some extent, you have to, in advertising, the trick is really to start from a different place from everybody else, or to notice something that nobody else has noticed or people have rejected as being trivial, and then rinse and repeat. You continually then follow that insight and see where it takes you. And so one of my unfashionable opinions, but I still think I'm right, is I'm a big fan of chains. Starbucks, Costa Coffee, you know, Holiday Inn Express, Premier Inn, Travelodge. You know, I think they're marvellous. Now, let me explain why, okay? I grew up, as you did, I imagine, in Britain, at a time when if you booked a hotel at random, the odds are it was shit, okay? I think sometime in the 90s, I stayed in what you might call the last 1980s hotel in Britain. And, you know, the carpets were sticky. The double bed was actually two single beds roughly cobbled together. The thing was ghastly, right? Now, the great thing about chains isn't that they're brilliant. If you want a signal, you know, that you're a real coffee connoisseur, then the chains don't do it for you. But the great thing about chains is they don't set the ceiling, they do set the floor. And it basically goes, okay, if you want to sell coffee, that's fine. You've got to be kind of, you know, in the same ballpark as Costa. If you want to run a hotel, that's fine. You can survive. But you've got to find some way in which you're as good as or better than a Premier Inn, a Holiday Inn Express. Okay? And as a result, it gets rid of a huge... What we don't notice is the rubbish hotels that no longer exist because those places exist, and the excellent hotels which have been forced to become excellent because if they weren't, they wouldn't exist. And so, you know, I still hold to that argument that actually they, you know, those kind of pretty good, satisfying chains, you know, actually form a pretty... McDonald's must have done a hell of a lot for food, okay? And in the same way, there is an optimistic take, I suppose, on AI, that it leaves us to do the things that are remarkable and effectively takes over the things which are banal. You know, so now the only problem is, does that mean, you know, that anybody, any solicitor who makes money out of conveyancing, I don't know if you have them in Australia, but as a Brit, you'll know what that means, you know, of you know, house purchase, is basically out of a job completely, whereas, you know, the only legal jobs are for sort of really high-flying lawyers fighting sort of philosophical and ethical debates about unbelievably convoluted subjects. But at some level, some degree, I mean, one thing that could be very interesting, by the way, I think, is a human AI combination for customer service. So if you take live chat, now, I don't think you should just hand over to AI completely with live chat, but a lot of the mundane stuff, like the what's your security number, what's your postcode, can be done by the AI. The AI then can do some good context-setting questions and then hand over to the human, so the human does very well what humans alone can do. And there's a rather sweet finding from KFC in France, which is they introduced these screens where you ordered your food on the screen. But it was a slightly incomplete system because it then printed out your order and then you had to take the order to the desk rather than the order being fed straight through to the kitchen. Now, interestingly, I think this is interesting, they found it was very satisfactory because people did all the sort of what you might call the transactional stuff with the screen. Then they got the printout, took it up to the KFC counter, and they had a bit of a chat about, did you see the match last night? Obviously, they wouldn't do this if there's a massive queue, but, you know, if there weren't that many people around, and of course, because the system was quite efficient, there weren't that many people around, what you had was a perfect kind of yin and yang of the human and the automated. So yeah, there are areas where I'm hugely optimistic because it's done. I personally, okay, again, another eccentric opinion, I think it is perfectly tenable to live in a world where an AI assisted customer service representative on the telephone or on live chat could earn £70,000 or £80,000 a year. Okay, so if you're maybe more, okay, if you're really, really good at that, if you're really, really good at handling complaints, and you can spend more and more of your time on what you might call the decisive moments of the call, okay, and if to some extent the AI can learn from you up to a point, but not to the point where it replaces you, what you have there is, because one of the things that really depresses me is we spend a lot of money advertising service brands, okay, and working in an ad agency, and you present, as you're kind of obliged to do as an advertiser, the most positive impression of these wonderful brands, okay, and then being a good ad guy, you also sign up to these brands because it's good to use your clients' products for all kinds of reasons. And then they don't answer the bloody phone, or it takes 9 minutes to get them to answer the phone, or you have to listen for for music, or you get cut off, not like that. Now that always strikes me as extraordinary, because what you've done is you've presented a very high expectation of your business, and then completely failed to deliver at the first moment of truth. And that strikes me as one of the dumbest things businesses do. It's done really because the call center tends to be run by an operations person, okay, not by a marketing person, who sees it purely as a necessary cost, not as a brand building opportunity. And so their metrics are entirely about how many of these dumb calls they manage to clear in the course of a day and how brief they can make the call. Now, really, really good call center operative, and I've experienced about six of them in my life, can be a complete game changer. You know, they can actually make you loyal to a company for 6 years. You know, to be honest, I've probably stuck with the American Express card because I don't ring them very often, but every time I do, they're pretty damn good. Okay. And yet, because there's no way of measuring that directly, or if there were, it would be a very, very slow process of revealing the value, okay? I don't think enough value is given to that kind of thing, and nearly enough attention is given to that kind of thing, given the extent to which they'll agonize over every punctuation mark in an advertisement. It seems utterly stupid that they then basically don't answer the phone.
So the future could be AI call centers.
Well, that's only one application where I can see it as being potentially really, really good, in the same way that maybe McDonald's and KFC and everybody, by having the order pass straight to the kitchen, maybe they've made it just a bit too impersonal. There is one big benefit, the big benefit that comes from McDonald's having those screens where you order. Far more people now order two burgers for one person. Face to face, they were too embarrassed to do it. When it's a screen, they're pretty happy. This is what I hear on the street. But it's a fascinating thing in itself. I think there's something really interesting there, in that if you can create a kind of hybrid of personal and machine service. Same way, I suppose, what could you do with, a really interesting AI-informed property search website? Is there something you could do which didn't simply deliver houses that met the initial criteria of the person searching? That actually threw in wildcards and because think about this, okay? When you go to a property website, okay, it's only answering one question, which is what you want. Okay. The estate agent, consciously or unconsciously, is actually asking two questions. He's asking, what would this person buy? He's also asking, what would this person buy that most people wouldn't buy? In other words, what could I sell to this guy that most people, most people wouldn't buy? And, if I went to an estate agent, I wouldn't be surprised if the estate agent didn't think, God, this guy's a bit of a weirdo. Finally, a chance to offload that bloody windmill, right? Now, I'm not searching for a windmill, but quite cleverly, what he's doing is searching for a person who would buy a windmill, i.e. me, just about. Okay. And so it strikes me that there's something, there are quite a lot of cases, I think, where we think we've made a perfect decision when we go to a property website, because every single decision has been an accurate answer to the question as we believed at the time. But what we don't see is what we're missing out on. I think there's something interesting there, which is that, I had a, interestingly, when I had an estate agent last sell me a flat, they interestingly sold me and recommended a cheaper flat. And it occurs to me that one of their reasons may have been that the cheaper flat was, to my mind, a better flat, but actually it was also slightly less picturesque and therefore harder to sell. I don't know. But it is kind of interesting because, you know, these questions of choice architecture and decision science need to be asked much more, because in many areas, not least dating, property, travel, flights, okay, we are now choosing things in a totally different way to the way we chose things 30 years ago. But also, and perhaps more worrying, we're all choosing them in the same way. Now, when markets were messy and lots of people had different preferences and so forth, markets acted as a kind of aggregator of overall tastes. If the choice architecture we put into a website effectively forces everybody to choose in the same way, the amount of information we're getting about what people really want and don't want is actually being reduced. We're becoming stupider. Does that make sense?
It does. And as you're saying that, I wonder, are we inadvertently moving towards a world that actually in some ways more closely resembles the, you know, the efficient markets hypothesis? Imagine a world
I think it's a world which pretends the efficient markets hypothesis is true and then proceeds accordingly. Do you see what I mean? Because, I mean, nobody, what people actually want and what people say they want aren't the same thing. We don't have perfect introspective access to our own utility function, as it were, okay? I don't know, you know. I mean, the most extreme case, okay, very interesting book and a great book by a wonderful guy, Russ Roberts, where he makes the point that the whole notion of a rational decision has to be qualified, because many decisions, once made, change our utility function so that a decision made previously under our pre-existing utility function is to some extent necessarily irrational. Okay. And perhaps the best case of that is having kids. I don't know if you've got kids. Have you got kids? Right.
I do indeed.
Okay. If you ask a childless couple of, say, 28, what do you enjoy doing? They say going on exotic holidays, having a lot of disposable income, shopping for clothes, staying out late, you know, whooping it up, going to parties, okay? Now, based on their current preferences, the decision to have kids is unbelievably stupid, right? Because it basically militates against all of those things. But the point is that once you've had a kid, your preferences are so changed by the existence of the kid that what you stated was important to you beforehand. It's rather like, you know, a much more minor equivalent is having a Japanese toilet. Nobody wants a Japanese toilet, but once you've had one, a basic toilet seems so absolutely pathetic and insanitary by comparison, okay? It's inconceivable that you'd ever go back.
I'm laughing away, and I'm wondering what proportion of our listeners are going to hear that and think, yes, absolutely, as I am, versus those who think that we've now gone completely stark raving bonkers. But yes,
of all the innovations, I mean, if you think of all the money, first of all the money spent on things like fashion, okay, which someone once described fashion as innovation without improvement, okay, you know, you look at money spent on interior decor and aesthetics and all that sort of thing. Actually spending money on a toilet that cleans your bum is definitely in the responsible and logical segment, okay, of human consumption. I don't apologize for that, but I mean, it is weird that, I mean, actually, to be honest, the Western world is an outlier in that the Islamic world will tend to have a bum gun, as will Thailand, for example, quite large parts of Southeast Asia. The Japanese world, obviously, you know, is the home of the shower, the bidet toilet, or the shower toilet. It's actually slightly weird that Western Europeans and Americans, particularly how when you consider how fastidious Americans are about lavatory seats, okay, right? Okay, it is a bit weird, actually, how much resistance there's been both to the bidet and the shower toilet.
I love that.
Are they making it into Australia? I mean, do you have enough Asian influence of your toilet design, your dunny design?
I was in Melbourne a couple of weeks ago, and my hotel room, much to my surprise, did come complete with a Japanese toilet. So I haven't seen one in Perth,
yeah,
but in Melbourne, yes.
Interesting.
Now, Rory,
I'm tell me which hotel time. That is. I will make a mental note to stay there. Yeah,
it's the W in Melbourne,
right
on Collins Street. Now, I'm very conscious of your time. I have just one more question as we move on from Japanese toilets. Now, some of our regular listeners have probably picked up my penchant for middle-aged dad rock. So Dilip Soman and I briefly discussed Depeche Mode and what they can tell you about human nature. And the whole episode was actually named after my favorite Pink Floyd song, which is Us and Them. So I'm now duty-bound to continue this.
Who are you speaking to when you spoke about Us and Them? Who was your guest?
Dominic Packer.
Ah, then what's his specialism? That's intriguing.
So he wrote a book called The Power of Us, which, as I said to him at the time, sounded like an Oprah Winfrey best-selling self-help book.
Yeah.
But is in fact, it's co-written with another professor called Jay Van Bavel, but it's about the power of social identity to shape behavior. It's fascinating. If you haven't read it, you must.
I will go and dig that out. That sounds absolutely marvelous. Okay, thank you.
But moving on from Pink Floyd, I'm going to ask you now about Bob Dylan, because I think this is a good way of summing up everything we've talked about. What exactly, Rory, is Dylanomics?
Oh, it's Dylan, actually, I'd also put Jesus very high on the pantheon of behavioral scientists avant la lettre, as it were. And, you know, if you think about it, the parable of the lost sheep, parable of the vineyard, etc. Okay. They're all kind of interesting psychological reflections on loss aversion, for example, or perceived fairness. You know, in many ways, they are kind of describing putative behavioral economics experiments. Okay. You know, we had N sheep. Okay. Anyway, right. But Dylan is interesting, particularly I think it's in reference to a song which is on an obscure album, but it's an absolutely magnificent song called Brownsville Girl. And there are various phrases like people don't do what they say they believe, they do what's convenient and then they repent, okay? And there's some other fantastic, you know, you don't mean to trespass, but sometimes you just find yourself over the line, etc., etc. But there are about 8 phrases in the song, which are, in a sense, brilliantly kind of useful little aphorisms around, you know, our psychological tendencies. It's a song I really, really recommend to you. It's very long, so it's not surprising there's some great stuff in it, but it really is magnificent. I'll try and think of a few more of the marvelous behavioral economics things that occur there, but it's you know, I think that, you know, that point that actually, you know, we do what's convenient and then we post rationalize in some cases or else repent, you know, I find that fundamentally interesting in the, you know, the whole point about how in a sense we act instinctively and then construct a post rationalized narrative after the event. I find that very, very interesting indeed.
I find it fascinating, and I observe it actually with children. There is this, yeah. I don't know what the age is when children get good at explaining or coming up with a rational, plausible explanation for what they've just done. But you see them when they're quite young, they attempt to justify something they've done. And it's complete nonsense. It's complete hokum, and very obviously so. And part of the process of growing up is working out is working out what is an acceptable, plausible justification for whatever you've done.
Yes, okay, you're absolutely right. I never thought of that, but you know, you come home, for example, and there'd be shit all over the floor, and they'd come up with some story about how, you know, it came in through the window or something. absolutely true. Yeah. And the age at which that happens is an interesting one. It's probably around 4 or 5. Other things really interest me about having children. One of the things that fascinated me about having children was how early the humour instinct developed. Okay? Because you'd understand the need for humour in, okay, teenagers or people who, you know, in a social setting. But why is humour there so early? What's it, you know, what's it for? Is it a bonding, parental bonding thing? No idea. Absolutely no idea.
It's a fascinating topic. Robin Dunbar has some thoughts on this.
Oh, go on, hit me with it. Yeah, I'd love to know what is, because there's a guy, wonderful guy we had at Nudstock, whose name I've briefly forgotten. I'll remember it in a second, who's a professor of humour at, I think, in Colorado, the University of Boulder, I think.
I've also forgotten his name, but I know exactly who you mean, because he has this great technique called shitstorming, which I use all the time, which is reverse brainstorming. It's this idea that if you come up with the worst possible idea...
Have you ever come up with a good idea through shitstorming?
Yes, so it's very interesting, because a lot of the time, and this will inadvertently play into a quote of yours that you use all the time, but quite often the opposite of the shit idea is the good idea. So you've got this array of shit ideas, and you just flip them around and they become good. But one of the other benefits is it increases psychological safety, because essentially when you're in a room full of people trying to come up with bad ideas, no one is self-conscious about their bad idea.
Of course.
But just occasionally, the bad idea that everyone laughs at, you pause for a moment and say,
Hold on a second. That's what we should do. Yeah, I remember.
I can't remember his name either.
Jeremy Bulmore had a similar exercise in advertising, which he called some brandicide, which is to understand a brand, you decide what would be the worst single decision that brand could take. You know. At one point, they had a premium brand called After Eight Mints. You'll remember them. They were one of their clients. And I think Jeremy Bulmore, someone's first suggestion was that you produce After Eight chewing gum. And someone said, yeah, there's a problem there, because actually a premium range of mint-flavoured chewing gum could actually do quite well. Okay. And then someone came up with bubble gum, and that was considered perfect, because they were at that point completely incongruous. But it's interesting how it's such a wonderful creative technique, which is just do it backwards.
It's a great example. And I've remembered the guy in Colorado's name is Pete McGraw.
Pete McGraw, wonderful guy, yeah, fantastic. Hi there, Pete. And by the way, it's Paul Bloom, not Paul Zak, who's written Against Empathy.
Okay.
Sorry, and okay. I need to find out, there is a book that Paul Zak has written, but I'll need to find out what it is.
I think Paul Zak, if I recall rightly, I haven't read his book, but I've read some of his work on the neuroscience of trust.
And the moral molecule, probably, and the trust factor, yeah.
All right, Rory, thank you. I'm very conscious we've gone over. I could talk about this all night, and I know you could.
It's been a huge pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. People don't do what they believe in. They just do what's most convenient. Then they repent. Turns out Bob Dylan was a behavioral scientist. Who knew? There's so much to unpick from more than an hour of conversation with Rory. I feel like I could record an hour-long dissection to match. Don't worry, I won't. But there's so much to take away from that. Rory's observation that governments default to bribery or prohibition is really accurate. And as he said, it's not really that surprising, given that governments, at least in Western countries, are mostly populated by lawyers and economists. Organisations, thankfully, usually hire from a broader talent pool. Yet so often the way that they treat their employees boils down to the same techniques. And that's for the simple reason that so much of management theory is lifted straight from the pages of economics textbooks. But humans aren't robots, and we don't make decisions like robots. As Rory said, that's a distinction that's more important than ever with the rise of AI. I love his speed camera example. The rationale for passing more and more decision-making to algorithms is that humans are really poor at consistently applying logical rules. We're no match for computers on that front. But what Rory's saying, and it's really impossible to disagree, is that that's a feature, not a bug, in the way that humans work. That ability to incorporate context is absolutely critical, and it's a key difference between humans and machines. It's terrifying the extent to which our lives have already become ruled by mindless application of logical rules. The global financial crisis that began in 2007 is often painted by the media as a result of wild speculation by cowboy gamblers taking huge risks. The reality is much more frightening. The crisis actually occurred because bankers had become convinced that the sophisticated models and the complex products they'd created had actually removed the risk. But the models were built on pure logic and didn't take account of human psychology. It's a mistake we make at our peril. Bob Dylan is a terrible singer, and he's certainly not a mathematician or an economist. But he really understands people, which is more than can be said for most mathematicians and economists. Perhaps the world needs a bit less economics and a bit more Dylanomics. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Izzy Rackage and presented by me, James Healy.